Prime Matters presents this series on prayer and discernment with Monsignor Thomas Richter and Father Dominic Bauch, chaplain of the University of Mary. PrimeMatters.com is a groundbreaking project of educational outreach of the University of Mary, awakening the Catholic imaginative vision. Episode 1, The Christian Vision of Prayer.
Hello and welcome. This is Father Dominic Bauch, chaplain of the University of Mary, and it's my honor today to be joined with Monsignor Thomas Richter, a friend of mine, of course, but also a great priest of our diocese. He's served in high school and parish ministries, but above all, especially on the topics that we're going to talk about today, he has vast experience with young people, prayer, and discernment. And from that experience, he's been able to gather a whole corpus of understanding of our spiritual lives and our ability to make choices and have fundamentally, at the end of the day, a deep relationship with God. If you want to know more about these things, he's written many pamphlets, primarily known for Is Jesus Calling You to Be a Catholic Priest, a guide for young men whether to become a priest, and Integrated Evangelization, which is a guide for all of us, which I find personally very helpful, of how just am I supposed to spread the gospel. So if you are interested, please check out those written materials. But Monsignor, thank you for being here.
It's a joy and an honor to be with you, Father Bell.
And so,
and a pleasure.
Well, the pleasure's all mine. As chaplain of the university, I deal every day with, you know, young people and their relationship with God. And, you know, very often one's experience with that relationship with God is one of anxiety or feeling like you're not doing well enough. You talk about this gap sort of between dogma and experience, or my personal experience of what I believe. Can you just talk about why there's a divide there, and then obviously how do we bridge that gap?
Yeah, you articulated a real issue, a real concern, a real challenge for just about every believer, but in particularly for the young. And I, in my experience, if we don't assist them in understanding and interpreting their interior experience, this gap between dogma, what we believe, and their experience can easily lead them to conclude to things that would be opposed to what divine revelation has made clear. And so what I call conclude to a secular vision, or my more preferred term, pagan vision, versus the Christian view and understanding of our relationship, the relationship between God and the human person, God and the human heart, God and the human soul. I use those interchangeably. So, yeah, to use your language, one of the great needs for us, you and me, as chaplains and ministers of the young, is to help them bridge that gap, that great abyss between what we believe versus our experience of that. I remember this. I'm not exaggerating. I remember being in junior high, elementary school, having a firm sort of understanding or being taught through catechism, through my parents, the Eucharist is Jesus. The Eucharist is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. And so I remember going back to my pew at St. Hildegard's, having received the Eucharist, wondering why I'm not experiencing what I would have expected to experience when you receive the second person of the Blessed Trinity. And in my little mind, there were some days when you would wonder, is this in fact true? Is what we believe true, and there's something wrong with my experience?
Yeah.
Or is my experience actually telling me the truth? And so we have to wonder about what we believe. And so I think it's incredibly important in the new evangelization, Father Bauch, as you know, working with the great student center, that we really help them with this, and we get them to say these things out loud. So Here would be an example, or a couple of examples, of a Christian understanding, a Christian vision to interpreting the inner experience and the secular. So, for example, if in fact I'm in darkness, if in fact I'm in a dark room, if in fact I'm experiencing darkness, I could conclude, right? I could interpret and conclude that there's no light in this room. And so I got to somehow find a source of light, electricity, a lamp, a light switch, etc. And the problem is I lack light. This would be the secular interpretation of the interior experience of God. So when we don't experience the truth of what we think we should, if in fact the Blessed Trinity lives in me through baptism, then we could the secular vision concludes that I got to somehow find this God that I'm not experiencing. The Christian vision, right, if I'm sitting in darkness, the Christian interpretation of that experience when it comes to relationship with God is I have blindfold on and I simply need to remove the blindfold. The difference between those two interpretations is an incredible abyss, which will lead to incredibly different lifestyle, very different spiritualities, and then very different approaches to God. Another example would be thirsty, right? If I'm thirsty, I could think that I need to find the source of water. There is no water. I got to find water, a well, a fountain, a faucet, whatever, a bottle of water that we have to pay for now. Or I could be, the Christian interpretation is when it comes to a relationship with God, is I'm standing under Niagara Falls, thirsting, and all I need to do is open my mouth. That if, in fact, I conclude with a Christian interpretation, now everything changes in regards to how I approach my relationship with God. Is that what you're talking about with this gap?
Right, and there's kind of a paradigm that Jesus reveals to us in the story of the prodigal son or the merciful father, that you know the son, after he's abandoned his father, has this rehearsed speech of how he's gonna get back into his father's house as a hired worker. And you know the great line that when his father sees him from a long way off, runs out to meet him. That this idea that we have to somehow convince God to care about us and love us when the whole time he was in a hell of his own making, which we can talk about heaven and hell later, but the hell that he was in was his own choice. It wasn't the Father's choice, and he could be back in good relationship with his Father when he wanted. Now, practically, you talk about the blindfold or sitting under Niagara Falls in terms of analogies, but like in terms of actually, how does that look?
Very good. If you would let me use that, I like the parable of the prodigal son that you just brought up. What I find more helpful is, in fact, the experience of the elder son.
Right.
So if you recall, the younger son comes back. The father says, "You're my son, not a slave." Throws him a party, kills the fatted calf. Remember, the elder son doesn't come in. The elder son is expressing.
Yeah.
The elder son is expressing in just beautiful, clear language the secular interpretive vision of relationship with God. If you remember, the father goes out and says, "Hey, son, why aren't you in there? We're having a party. Your younger son has returned, blah, blah, blah." And if you remember, the elder son says, I have worked for you my whole life. Yep. I've never disobeyed one of your orders, but you have not given me so much as a kid goat to celebrate with my friends. And if you recall, the father says, all that I am,
yeah,
I have given you. He has just articulated, yeah, the father has just articulated the Christian imaginative vision, mm-hmm, of relationship with God. So the father is saying to the elder son, you're swimming in a big lake, you're standing under Niagara Falls, and you're thirsty. But it's not because it's not being given. And so the elder son's situation is he is not receiving what is being given. This is the fundamental Christian interpretive vision that we need to articulate, in my opinion. We need to articulate in convincing, effective ways to help people understand what the exercise of faith and the exercise of hope is about in the human heart. Because the secular vision would encourage us to keep doing the elder son thing to get the father to be good, which only ends up at some point being frustrated and living in an experience that says, in many ways, screaming in my mind, what we believe isn't true. Yeah. Because my experience will not confirm it. If in fact what we believe is true and we enter into reality through the exercise of the theological virtues of faith and hope, we should actually experience mm-hmm. the truth of what we believe. I think that was a Christian statement, right?
Yeah.
And so the elder son needs to now step back and say, oh my gosh, my problem isn't that the father doesn't love me. My problem isn't that the father isn't giving himself. My problem isn't that the father isn't with me. My problem isn't that the father isn't willing my good and has profound care in him for me. My problem is I don't know how to enter into it.
Right.
I don't know how to experience it. This, I think, is the starting point for all the new evangelization. But if us supposed new evangelizers don't diagnose the issue that way, we are part of the problem, not part of the solution. And we can actually encourage more elder sons.
Yeah.
So what is the issue? Why is this so? Why are these two positions and visions so different? Because their visions of God are so different.
Right.
The secular vision of God, at one way, in one form or another, sees God with some unactualized potency. You remember from your St. John Vianney days, right? Our philosophy days, that God is pure act. That was really uninspiring to me when I was in the seminary. It's incredibly inspiring to me now and helpful for my students. Namely, there is no greater good God could be doing now. So there's no potential in God that I actualize. And therefore, so then what is my posture before God? My posture before God is to let God do what he's doing. And which is now a whole nother question.
Right. There's the kind of the silly Ben Franklin quote, which actually gets it right. You know, beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. And I think sometimes, you know, especially the very sort of horrifying views of what Christianity is supposed to be, especially in those days, you know, Puritanism or with Jansenism within the Catholic tradition, that fundamentally God is pretty much this close to just wiping us off the face of the earth and getting rid of us, and we just have to do all we can to maintain. Of course, like you talk about pagan versus Christian, that's the pagan view of prayer, of sacrifice, is these capricious gods who are more powerful than me are about getting ready to kill me. And so I need to make the right sacrifices in just the right way that get them to like hold off for just a moment. Or, you know, even a positive version of it, that I need my crops to do really well. And so I need to offer the sacrifice so that I experience the bounty of the crops. And it's so funny how clearly not Christian that is, especially when you look at the prayer of Christ himself. When the Our Father, you know, he says, thy will be done. But even more poignant, and this is, we're going to talk about relational prayer, to acknowledge where you're at. He's at the agony of the garden. He's perfect, so we know this is the right way to pray. And he says, you know, Father, let this cup pass from me, you know, but not my will, thy will be done. Where it's what you're saying of saying, I think most of our prayer would be, let this cup pass from me, meaning the crucifixion. Yeah. He knows exactly what's going to happen. Hey, I don't want this, right? And that's natural to say that this is going to be on a certain level a terrible experience. But to say, not thy will, my will, but thy will be done. But you have to presuppose that that God in and of himself wants what's best for you.
That's right.
I think it's the scariest thing. I always say, if you have a button that said, if you hit this button, God's will be done in your life 100%. His will, wouldn't we be, you know, we're a little scared to hit it because we think, well, look at what happened to Jesus. He got crucified. I don't think that's a great, you know, outcome. But to say, no, he got crucified because that is the happiest possible outcome that he could have had for his life, because it's a perfect...
Very good, Father Bach. So the foundation, then, the terra firma, the solid ground that we stand on, right? You just made this brilliant point that what we're talking about is not some new sort of insight that we read on the bulletin board of a spirituality center, that this is rooted firmly in the scriptures and firmly in the heart of Jesus. How did Jesus pray? Jesus' heart did not go to God to get God to do something.
Yes.
Jesus was utterly fascinated with all the goodwill his Father had, all the great care plans the Father had for him. His will was always a loving goodwill. And Jesus' heart was utterly fascinated with, how do I let the Father get his way with me? Mm-hmm. How do I give him permission? This is what faith does. Faith, at the end of the day, receives from God. Faith lets the good, loving Father act. So that's the first thing. This isn't new. This is precisely how Jesus's heart worked. We also see it, of course, in the Blessed Mother. What we're describing is the heart of Mary. Mary first received so deeply, God was born in her, and then she had a Savior to give. But if a heart doesn't know how to receive, we have nothing to give. Corbon, right? Jean, yeah. Corbon wrote the fourth book of the Catechism on prayer. And he says, the most fruitful activity of the human person is to be able to receive God. So it's not new. It's fruitful, and as you said, one of the stakes in the ground, in order for one to do this, the first thing faith sees is God has goodwill toward me. The more I have faith, yeah. The more I see in a sustained, unchanging, unquestionable manner, the Father right now, who holds all of the universe in existence, is using all his power, all his intelligence, to show me good. Second, which I find very common, even in my own imagination and my own prayer, and especially with these kids I use, that when it comes right down to it, we really swim in deism.
Yeah.
That God isn't ever active. Because my experience doesn't feel like he's doing anything, I conclude God isn't doing anything. And so I do my holy hour, and then he does something. I go to Mass, and then he does something.
Yeah.
So the two things faith sees foundationally is this: God's will is always a loving, good will, and two, he is ever active. Thus, back to this, right? No unactualized potency in it.
Right.
And so when faith sees those two things, faith says, my life as a disciple begins and ends by actively receiving from him. And that would be a good episode.
Right, yeah.
What does actively receiving from God look like? And how does the elder son get out of his mess? Right, because the elder son is expressing, you want to get people to listen to you at Mass? Preach on the experience of the elder son or Martha.
Yeah.
And everybody leans and looks for, why? Because they identify with their experience. And so this is what the elder son and Martha need to do is they need to receive from God actively. And what does that look like? And so, right, the first, I want to stress actively. Yeah. It's not passive. If it's passive, then we should not, we should avoid it, right? Corbone said, what is the most fruitful activity? Not passivity, not what's the most fruitful nothing I can not do, but the most fruitful activity of the human person, and that is to read. So it is an active receptivity.
So, you know, even the phrase itself has that beautiful kind of paradoxical flavor to it. And it's always hard, you know, I'm sure you catch yourself sometimes too, but you're such a master at it that you probably never make a mistake. But whenever, even if to say, you know, the question, which you, both of us hear so much, what should I do in prayer?
That's right.
You don't want to, it's hard because you don't just say, well, you just sit there and receive, right. Like you're a plant, right? That's not what we are. But that act of receptivity, can you say a little bit more like practical level?
Very good.
I carved out, and we'll talk about this too,
yeah.
Of like, I just don't find time to pray. Well, that's probably because your time in prayer isn't very enjoyable, right? But when, say, I've committed 30 minutes of my life before my day starts to spend time with Jesus, what does that look like?
Very good, very good. Well, I have more than a little to say about that.
Good.
But the first is, so what does this active receptivity look like? Like if I'm being moved by the spirit of faith and not by the spirit of paganism, mm-hmm. that is like the Romans and the Greeks tried to get their gods to be good to them,
right.
Which is what can drive prayer for decades in a person. But they're not actually praying in faith, and thus they're not receiving. So what is that? What is the great work of faith? You look in the Gospels, and it's on every other page. What do the people who receive from Jesus, receive Jesus's power, receive his healing, receive his loving will, receive his grace, his love, his care, his forgiveness, what do? They do basically two things. First of all, they see in Jesus loving will. They see in Jesus power. They see in Jesus he wants to do something for me. So they acknowledge their need. They acknowledge their need. The elder son would say, Father, I need to experience your care for me. I need to experience that you are good to me. And he needs to get away from, I got to get him to be good.
Right.
He needs to start now moving into the area, start leaning in to being honest and give himself permission to admit, Father, I don't experience your goodness. I don't experience your care. They acknowledge that. And then two, and so that's what they did in the Gospels. Right? My daughter's sick. Let's bring her to Jesus. So they acknowledge the need. That's what's on every page of the gospel. When you start reading the gospels through these lenses, it's on every page.
Yeah.
What are the people who are encountering the goodness of God, the power of God doing? They're acknowledging their need. And then two, they're bringing it to Jesus. In our language, they're acknowledging and relating. And when one acknowledges and relates in faith, one receives. People, did you hear that? Mm-hmm. When you acknowledge and you relate, you receive. But once again, what needs to underline, what underlies this acknowledging and relating isn't a spirit of control that I got to get God to be good and I got to get him to do my will. No. For one who truly believes in God, one believes the greatest thing that can happen to me is for God, whatever God's willing in this to be done, to be done. So, right, when the son, if the son was to say, Father, I don't experience your care for me, I have a need to experience your care for me, I bring it to you. He does that not so the father somehow does precisely what he wants, but because he's convinced what the Father is wanting for him is the best thing that can happen. And so he does this in what you call an abandoning and trusting, surrendering way. This is the heart of Christian relational prayer. Acknowledge, relate, receive. Acknowledge, relate, receive. There's a million and one obstacles in that. People not being aware.
Mm-hmm.
One. Two, people being aware, but they're not humble enough to acknowledge. Huh? So the elder son's too tough to actually acknowledge, Father, I need love from you. I need to know your care. Because my service isn't leading me to care and love for you, but resentment.
Yeah.
And thus, at a certain point, either the elder son learns how to receive, or at a certain point, he says, I'm done. Catholics either learn how to receive, or at a certain point, they say they're done. And you're seeing that in a generational way in our church.
Right.
You're seeing, I'm bearing all kinds of people who lived the faith, but it didn't get passed to the next generation. That this experience of the elder son is preventing this experience, and then the interpretation of it wrongly is, I think, a great cause of people not entering into the faith and thus giving up and walking away from it. Our grandparents, there was enough support, there was enough things to keep a person.
Right.
Still appreciating it on one way, a level or another. So acknowledge, relate in faith, and one receives.